From the information revolution, it's not an enormous leap to talk about the history of information, and our next speaker, don't make sense, no, this should be great. LJ Rich. LJ is the managing director of Perfect Pitch Productions. It's tough at this time in the morning. And a reporter and producer for the BBC's flagship technology programme, Click. Now, I was reading her CV last night, and it made me feel like a right thicky. At the age of 11, she was awarded a scholarship to the Royal College of Music and followed that up with a degree in music at Christ Church College, Oxford. She's a voting member of BAFTA. This is the bit I don't get. Holds abnormally high scores in pattern recognition games. Anybody? I struggle with a quick crossword. And reviews restaurants in her spare time. You better be good.
Nice to meet you. My name's LJ Rich, and as we're talking about collecting information, analysing information, it's only right to start with some information about me, but somebody's obviously beaten me to it. That's all right, I don't mind at all. So we're going to talk about the history of information. We're going to talk about a few other things as well, the creative analysis of information, and then we're going to talk about what you can do when you have impressive amounts of information, the power of information, if you will. So, information about me. By day, I've got two jobs, probably like a lot of people. By day, I'm a not-so-mild-mannered reporter, freelancing for the BBC. And by night, and also every other waking hour that I can manage, I run this company, Perfect Pitch Productions. It provides bespoke music analysis, music composition, and it's a lot of fun, especially when I get very strange commissions, but I'll go into that in a minute. So I'm going to start off with, what is information? It's numbers. It's sound, it's data, it's art, and well, it's kind of all around us. I suspect that not only do my jobs, but probably all the jobs you do also involve using and manipulating information in some way. Behind me is the Mandelbrot set. That's a fractal pattern, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. And the one thing I love about this is it shows that data can be utterly breathtaking. All that is a graph plotting the possible answers to one equation. To me, that makes my brain buzz a little bit. There's something utterly transfixing about that. So very quickly then, I'm going to, that's a big subject change, but don't worry, I'll come back to it. This is the information about what I'm going to be talking about. First of all, a sort of run through of the evolution of information. Then I'm going to do an analysis of musical information with specific reference to the Eurovision Song Contest. I'll go into that. And then finally, I'll be talking about creativity from information, what you can really do with it. So first up, how information changed the world. Now, before I start on this, I've only picked 5 points, but obviously there are so many points where information has changed the course of the planet in the past. So bear with me, there's only a few, but I'm sure I've missed some out. Come and chat to me afterwards, I'm quite friendly. So let's go with the first one then. This is language, how I'm speaking to you right now, in fact. If my presentation's any good, then you'll understand what I'm saying and, you know, take something away from that. Not only am I assuming, though, that you can understand my speech, speaking in English, you're understanding in English, but also it's not just about what I'm saying, it's about how you're interpreting information. And the British Library says 3,000 years ago, that's where, no, actually it was 3,000 BC, that's where they reckon the earliest writing started, on a clay tablet. And unlike speech, writing doesn't change. The clay tablet doesn't change, but our interpretation of it does. That's quite interesting, and I will come back to that too. So next up, we've got the printing press. Obviously, in the Western world at least, this was one of the most significant advances in information. It democratized information. It made books plentiful and cheap. And for the first time, you could get access to information regardless of your class, regardless of your religious persuasion. It really was a great leveler in many ways. It standardized texts. That means that if you were talking about medicine, somebody else would have the same book with the same terms, and then everyone could work together and create progress on a grand scale. Next up, I know I'm going a few hundred years into the future already. We're already at the late 19th century, the telephone. Now, the telephone obviously transferred more than just words. We're looking at audio information. Tone of voice, something that's so lacking in emails. That's why we all have smiley faces, and you know, you don't have sarcasm, you don't have all of these tools that for us are so natural when we're talking natively to one another. Interestingly, the telephone wasn't a communication device. It wasn't just a communication device. It did start off as a broadcasting device, not unlike a radio today. What would happen is you would listen in on your telephone, it's called an electrophone, to theatre performances or opera. And you know, you'd hear it down the line, that transmission of audio information. The bit that I found very interesting is that just like today's mobile phones, you could have two different plans. You could have a pay-as-you-go model, where you put a coin in and listen, or you could have a yearly subscription to the electrophone, the telephone. And a yearly subscription cost £20. You could either have that yearly subscription, or you could have a servant for a year. I wonder what we prefer. Then, of course, we come on to radio and television. I've kind of lumped these two together because I think that there are some points in history where the two sort of interchange. So I'll talk about radio first. That was the beginning of the 1900s, really, or just around that. There were these crystal radios, which basically consisted of a very thin metal wire called a cat's whisker, and you'd make it touch a crystal in the right way, and when it made contact, you could listen to the radio with headphones. It almost sounds a bit science fiction. It's a really odd thing, but radio, once again, it changed the face of how information was received. In 1926, it was the general strike, and it was a year after the first long-wave transmitter was put up in this country. And there were no newspapers during the general strike, and people turned to radio for their information. Later on, when television closed down during the Second World War, not only did you have the President of France coming over to the UK to use radio to speak to the French resistance in France, which is amazing, but you've also got that way where radio covered about 98% of the population back then. I think it was in 1938, 98% of the population could listen to BBC radio. Today, according to Radar figures a couple of months ago, that's 92%. Just to give you an idea of that, only around 70% of people have broadband. So that kind of coverage all that time ago, I think that's incredible. And so many people found that radio gave them that lifeline for information. Because we are information omnivores, after all. But once again, I digress. I kind of like to. Okay, so we're on to television. Obviously, TV has so much power. The power of the media is not just audio and tone of voice, not just words, but pictures, moving pictures, and video. It's all too easy to forget the reality culture that we have today where we're watching celebrities eating repulsive things. You know, when you think about how we can watch people floating in space and get the emotion from seeing that exploration, or we can watch wild birds inside their nests, and you can just see that with the power of TV. And in 1984, a report by Michael Burke was seen by Bob Geldof, and that moved an audience, a world audience, from ignorance to massive action. Of course, you all know I'm talking about Live Aid. So there is power in disseminating information. And then, of course, we get to, well, kind of where we are now, where we're off to. And this is the web, the social web. Now we've got rich media, we've got video, we've got sound, we've got words, we've got audio. But more importantly, the web is talking back to us. We have interactivity. The problem now, when we're collecting information, is not how to get the information, but this is, it's the next revolution of the printing press. It's sorting through the information to find the correct bits of information. A perfect example is, how on earth would you believe a picture of an aeroplane that's landed on the Hudson River? That's exactly what happened on Twitter a few years back. That, I think, was the turning point in the social web. Where we go from here, I'm definitely going to be hopefully watching it from the front lines. I think this is a fascinating way to look at how we analyse the information that suddenly become available to us. So, we've talked a little bit about the history of information, and really, I could go into that for ages, but I'm not going to. I'm going to talk about something a little bit stranger. This is my musical analysis of the Eurovision Song Contest this year. Don't worry, I won't make you listen to any of it. I had to, so that you don't have to. That's the plan. And let me tell you, when I said yes to the commission, I didn't take into account that I'd have to sit down with nothing but lots of cake, a cup of tea and headphones and listen to the Eurovision Song Contest in its entirety. I would definitely think twice before I say yes to everything. Anyhow, so what happened was I had a commission for my company. They said to me, LJ, can you find out who sang the most out of tune? And I said, yes. And then I thought, how on earth am I going to do that? I said, why did you ask me? And they said, well, we couldn't find a machine. I said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, no, we need a human being to do it because actually it's not as easy as it sounds. I mean, obviously all of us can hear when something's horrifically out of tune. But having a machine that can tell the difference between a tune and a melody and the accompaniment and being able to pull out that tune and decide whether it's in tune with the accompaniment, suddenly it becomes a little bit more complicated. And so humans win in that case. So they said to me, right, we'd like you to count all the right notes of the tune and all the wrong notes of a tune. And I tried that with a test song. It was I Know Him So Well by Elaine Page and Barbara Dixon. And I sat there on YouTube and I counted all the right notes and a couple of like, squiffy notes. And the one I listened to had 316 right notes and 9 wrong notes. I thought, well, who cares? That's really not interesting at all. It made me, you know, I actually had tears in my eyes trying to count the right notes. And I just thought, there must be a cleverer way to analyse this information so that not only is it interesting for me, but it's interesting for people to watch instead. So I said, hang on. I said, are there any rules on the Eurovision Song Contest? Do the songs have to be a certain length? And they said, yes, they have to be 3 minutes. I said, right, brilliant. I'm going to outsource this. I'm going to get someone else to count how many seconds each song lasts. And then I'm going to count the bum notes, and then we'll arrive at a wrong notes per minute ratio that means that I can judge each one separately. I should also mention that in as much as it's not very scientific, because it's just me saying something's out of tune or not, I did have some criteria, which is out of tune doesn't count ad-libbing. You know, the sort of Mariah Carey stuff, that's fine if it sounds all right. But if it's out of tune with the backing track, then wrong note. So this is my raw data chart. Looking at it now makes my eyeballs melt. It's horrific. And, you know, it's one of those things that you can see, and I put this up on my blog post as well, and this really, I was so surprised to find quite a lot of people zoomed into this picture and studied it and told me what they thought as well. There is something about that sort of data that people want to mash up and play with. So in there, I've got the key on the album, I've got what style of music it is, I've got how many people were on the stage, how many people were actually doing anything on the stage, and then, of course, I've got how many wrong notes, how many right notes, and what people sort of sounded like, you know, songs that they kind of paid tribute to, stole from, I don't know. Anyhow, so here are my results. Wrong notes per minute. Serbia was top with 38.5. Moldova was second, and Germany, who came first, of course, had 21.9. If you're wondering where the UK was, they were fourth, most out of tune, with 16.7 bum notes per minute. Not so bad, actually. Shame they weren't working on who was in tune. So I suddenly had that raw data sheet. You remember how complicated that looked. I decided to pull more out of it. This was over and above what I was commissioned to do. I'm just a geek that way. I had this amazing data set and I wanted to play with it. So any of you musicians in here, anyone play a musical instrument? Okay, a few of you. So you might be smiling when you see the most popular key is C. For those of you who don't read music, that is the one with no black notes, no sharps, no flats. Basically, you could do this and it would sound in tune. And that's what happened. Also, the unpopular songs, C-sharp and B-flat, the musicians will also know that those are quite complicated. Unless you're a clarinet player, where B-flat is fine, but then that's pitch B-flat, and the clarinet plays C as B-flat. I digress, and you know we don't really want to go into that. But I'd be happy to talk to you about that for hours afterwards, because having perfect pitch and knowing something is C, and a clarinet plays a C, but it's actually B-flat, anyhow, I won't even get into that. So, I've got this amazing data set. How many songs sounded like Queen? Because I'd gone through and heard all the songs and what phrases they've taken sort of from other songs, not intentionally, there are only 12 notes in a sort of scale anyhow, I've just realised this is a key note speech, because I'm talking about keys. I can't believe that. Sorry. I normally hold those puns in. So yes, three songs sounded like Queen. Israel and Iceland used The Show Must Go On. The chords are exactly the same. And Russia used I'm Going Slightly Mad, which I thought was quite interesting. But the other thing is Bob Dylan and Gabriella on there. That's Knocking on Heaven's Door. And that's another, those are chord sequences that just turn up everywhere. It's prevalent among music. But when you analyse it, it suddenly lifts that raw data up into something that begins to make a bit more sense. Yes, this bit is... the end bit is when Josh sings That Sounds Good to Me. It's exactly the same as Pat feels he's a really happy man. I'll let you go and listen to that afterwards. So, I thought, I've got all of this data, but look at this. The top three songs are all in a minor key. Hang on a minute, that's a little bit strange. I wonder if there are any commonalities in the bottom. Oh, hang on, the bottom three songs are all in a major key. Just to explain to people who are not musically minded, major keys are sort of happy and minor keys are miserable. You know, I'm trying to think, the EastEnders theme tune is actually happy. And then I'm thinking of, so Star Trek, I only like happy tunes. Most news songs are sort of probably major, but minor keys are you know, the piano music that goes in the background of the reality shows when you get the drama and somebody's looking sad and they're talking about something before they really want to do well and you want the audience to identify with that person who's going through a difficult time. That is minor keys. Okay, so we've got our bottom three songs and our top three songs. This made me wonder, can we pen a winning Eurovision song? Well, is it ethical? That's a bit topical. Well, can we do it? There's quite a lot of scoring commonalities once a geek like me gets into it and has a look. First of all, the top three songs are all contemporary style. That's things like the White Stripes, the Ting Tings, the sort of things, the bands you've not heard of, but they're not familiar to you, but they sound kind of cool. The bottom three songs were Whitney Houston, power ballads. Wait, there is nothing wrong with the odd power ballad. You should see the embarrassment of cheese that I've got on my MP3 player at home. But for Eurovision, it doesn't work. Top three songs all had folk elements to it, very interesting instrumentation. The bottom three songs were drums, bass, guitar, pad. You hear it, you kind of know what you're doing. And of course, the minor and major key. The bit that I thought was really interesting was if we could pin a winning song, which had all the characteristics, would this work for the Eurovision? And not necessarily. You lot are all going to be ahead of me here. Obviously, there's going to be politics involved. When I put this post up on my blog site, it was amazing how many people said, well, some countries vote for each other just because they're friends. Yeah. Also, when you look at something like geography, we're looking at the proximity. If you're on the border of two countries and you can hear two countries' music, then you know it doesn't really matter where you are if you like a particular song. And finally, familiarity. The winning song this year had a lot of airplay across Europe. I believe it was number one in a few places as well. So that familiarity, certainly for music, is going to be something that will make it a bit more likely to win. Of course, only, I believe, six songs in the final were in English. Weren't in English. That's one to get right, isn't it? Six songs weren't in English. Everything else appears to be in the lingua franca. The last two winning songs were also in English. So we've got a little bit of interest there. It shows that it's not necessarily a closed system. Although, interestingly, last year, Norway's winner, 2009, was in a minor key, had folky instruments, and was quite contemporary. So maybe there is something in it after all. Finally, I'm going to talk about what you can do with enough information. This blew my mind. This, have a listen actually. So Johann Sebastian Bach was born in 1685, and he's one of my heroes. He's awesome. If he was around today, I would be so starstruck, I'd just be able to go, hello, if I met him. You know, this guy wrote over 1,100 different compositions. They're beautiful, they're mathematical, they're perfect. 1,100 compositions, that's an amazing data set. Hang on, this sort of data is crying out to be analysed by someone. And so somebody has. Okay, so one of those pieces I just played you was Bach. The other one was from the composer on the right, a computer. So how many of you think that the first one was Bach? Okay. How many of you think the second one was Bach? The second one is a computer. It's called Emmy, And this was an experiment in musical intelligence from a chap called David Cope. Don't worry, I can't tell the difference either. In fact, I absolutely love the stuff that comes out of this computer's brain. The bit that's fascinating is that David Cope, who's already an acclaimed composer, fed all of Bach's work into a computer program. Crucially, he also added the things when Bach breaks his own rules into there as well. And that kind of little bit of unpredictability that Bach himself made also gave us this incredibly stirring music. I couldn't believe it when I heard it. I mean, I've listened to a lot of music. The thing is it still Bach? You know, if